And you, what were your options in terms of what kind of institutional setting you would return to to practice bench science? What did you have other options besides going to Cornell and to a medical college?
I wasn't applying to anything, and so Cornell, had this position for me ready. To come back to, all I had to do was say yes, and so, it was either that or CDC, and so, I had to. I mean, that was a big decision. Do I really want to go into academics? And sort of go through the fighting for grants and, do some clinical work at the same time. And so I negotiated with Warren Johnson about my expectations, and if I joined Cornell, I wanted to minimize my clinical responsibilities, and, I wanted to do international work and then do bench science, and he agreed to everything I asked. And so that's what I did. So
did you have clinical responsibilities?
Just a month. In the AIDS ward every year, so it's minimal. And it was mostly teaching, and I didn't have to write any notes in the charts or anything like that. So it was perfect arrangement. It was exactly
patient.
What I wanted. Yeah, minimal patient contact.
And how were you able to get funding for your lab after being out of kind of the loop for a couple of years?
Cornell, of course, had a startup package, right? Okay. So, I was able to get the lab set up with that, and then... a few months into my first year, I was able to reactivate this grant that I had from Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Okay.
So that was that. And then I had an opportunity to apply for inside program called the Cornell Scholars in Biomedical Science, which I was able to get. And that was for, 3 years. And so that covered, much of the needed support, technician, my salary. Then I got the Pew, and then I got the NIH, grants. So there's an accumulation, over time, and different things. That has also a lot of local, small grants from New York City. That's a real advantage of being in New York City. Just all these foundations and services that, and because TB was becoming so hot, that, I was able to get some small grants in there. And the postdocs that came, Warren Johnson supported some of the postdocs through his own grants, so I didn't have to pay for the salary of the postdocs. It was a very supportive, place for new faculty members studying it. So, I was very lucky, I think.
To continue on this issue of funding, when you applied for the private sources of money, how did those applications differ then from, say, the large federal grants that you applied for and the R01s from NIH?
You have to admit, my first couple of R01 grant applications got turned down.
Okay.
So, with E. coli work. And so, it's much easier to get the funding from the private sources.
Why is that the case? Why was that the case?
I think one is probably that many of these private sources were sort of local sources, though. So, there's certain, understanding or arrangements they had with major institutions in the area to provide funding, for new investigators and things. So I guess the tradition was there to tap into those things and made it easier. Whereas R01, was a national, competition,
right.
And it's much, so it's much more competitive. So I think that's one difference. And then, the funding that I got locally was all sort of related to TB.
Okay.
And because New York City had the worst TB problem in the country, I think any projects related to TB, there was a lot of opportunity to get funds. And so it was, again, the right time and right place to get those types of funding.
Yeah. And why do you think that your NIH grants, it took a while before you attracted the attention of?
Well, you know, I was starting out, you know, it was my first experience in writing R01s, and that was also a difficult time period. You know, that was like the funding level was, you know, quite low. I mean, and so, you know, I was in the midst of a period where, you know, maybe 12%, you know, the grants were getting funded, you know, at least from in our area, in the pathogenesis. You know, also I think, you know, my projects were not as well developed, you know, as, you know, they could have been. And then I guess the focus on the E. coli was not as urgent, you know, for them. And I think there is a certain sort of unwritten, I think, kind of a rule that, you know, NIH will fund a limited number of, you know, work related to certain pathogens that may not be all that important in the U.S. You know, there are a couple major labs working on the EPEC, you know, who was clearly much further ahead than I was. And so there was really no need, I think, you know, to have another lab doing EPEC pathogenesis work, even though, you know, we're addressing the pathogenesis question from a different point of view. So, you know, there are many reasons, I'm sure, you know, just the quality of the grant itself, the need for the research, that kind of research, and then, the, you know, just timing, you know, the difficult time getting grants. So it wasn't until I started, you know, accumulating data for the TB work that I was able to get grants, you know, from NIH and R01. My first, you know, R01 was a TB pathogenesis work. Mm-hmm. And again, that was also timing because TB was really hot. And mm-hmm. They had this extra money for TB, the set aside money for TB, the so-called, what is this, the term that's, you know, set aside for unblocking. Yeah, you're marked for them. But anyways, oh, it's called RFA.
Right, okay.
And so, you know, I was able to do that, and then the second project, I was able to collaborate with this person named Carr Nathan at Cornell, who's a nitric oxide expert. I was standing at the bus stop one day with my kids waiting for their school bus, and then Carr Nathan walked by and says, "Carl, you know, I know about this new RFA that's coming out to look at, you know, TB in the lungs." And we're joking initially, but we eventually wrote something, and then we got it. And so and it's probably the best collaboration I've ever had. And it's a really great, you know, collaboration and work.
So given that you have several projects that you have pursued, the EPEC and the TB projects. Mm-hmm. When it comes to setting priorities in your lab, how much does it influence, you know, the decisions on what you're going to do, what you're going to pursue,
mm-hmm.
when it's easier to get funding for hot topics? What drives your science at mm-hmm. that point when you know there's a lot of sources of private funding for certain diseases mm-hmm. and federal funding right. for certain diseases, and is it clinical interest at this point, or is it go where the money is?
No, it's really basic the science question that we want to pursue, and you know, my priorities are still TB and enteric diseases. That's always been the case. You're still doing too much, but you know, since we've done a lot, it's always difficult to stop something than to start something. And there's still enough interest, you know, in both fields, I think, both from private sources as well as, you know, in the government, that you know, if we can keep going on this, you know, that's what we'd like to do. There's certainly less interest in our EPEC work, and that's why Pew was very helpful. That was supported our EPEC work. You know, you are also definitely influenced by availability of funds for these projects. So you know, suddenly the funds run out for the EPEC work, you know, I probably will have to sort of stop that so I can focus on TB. I also probably will take a project to a certain point, and when I feel that it's done, it's answered all the you know interesting questions, then I sort of start winding down the project, especially if somebody else came up with something that was even more, you know, revealing and important, then, you know, I sort of lose interest in really pursuing something further. You know, I always feel that the need to, you know, be doing something that's novel and you know, it's really at the cutting edge, and if it's not, if it's just repeating somebody else's work or trying to confirm somebody else, then I lose interest in those things. So, and if that's facilitated by, you know, lack of funding there, then that makes it easier to, you know, stop those things. So there are many projects that we sort of start and then stop and, you know, and do other things. So, you know, within the field of TB and E. coli work. And even our salmonella work we just recently started, it's still related to TB. It's you know, it's still connected to TB. So I don't feel that that's really a real divergent sort of direction. And certainly, you know, by, you know, we're actually, we haven't got the money yet, but we had a good score on our RO3 application for the salmonella vaccine work. So clearly there's interest, you know, in that approach. So yeah, you know, it's really the science that drives the research first, and then try to see, you know, how we can manipulate the system to get funding to support that science. So I don't suddenly switch fields altogether just because there's money, you know. Here, I mean, there's been lots of money for AIDS. I've never, you know, tried to tap into that. I can certainly do work related to AIDS, you know, if I wanted to. TB, you can almost justify, but I've never applied to anything in the AIDS program for TB work. It's always been the pathogenesis section that I've tried to solicit money for. So.
And how does the source of funding, whether it's a private source like the Pew money or a federal source like a public source like the NIH, influence how you allocate resources in your lab day to day, like whether it's you know, reagents and supplies or equipment or personnel, grad students and postdocs?
Well, you know, that depends on what the agencies allow. If certain private foundations, you know, don't allow the money to be used for salary, then obviously, you know, I use them for, you know, other things, supplies and travel for the postdocs, or, you know, things like that. Yeah, unfortunately, you know, most of the private sources, it's unusual to you know, have funding that you can use for you know, paying salary of fellows, and so most of the salary support for the fellows come from NIH, you know, or NIH type of funding. So yeah, no, it's whatever the agencies, you know, allow you to do, we do. Sort of, you know, supply, you know, things here and there, and go back and forth, you know, between different funds to do whatever you know we need to accomplish. We also just got a funding from Fogarty International to do our international work, which you know, is another thing that I always have to worry about. You know, how do I keep things going abroad? And that's, you know, when I was at Cornell, it was a little easier because Warren Johnson was, you know, was very supportive. He was very successful in getting a lot of funds. But now I'm on my own here, and so I have to you know, come up with funds to send students there, support fellows there, support our collaborators there. And supplies. You know, it's,
and are there much? Is there much public sources of funding to do that kind of work?
No, unfortunately, it's difficult. You know, Fogarty is one source, and NIH has a couple of, you know, programs to do work abroad. You know, very competitive. So, unfortunately, there's not as many private sources, you know, for those things. I'm not sure why, but yeah, those are much more difficult to get. So. So, but you know, we keep struggling to to keep those things going. So.
And how do you see your prospects for the future in terms of funding future?
Never certain. You know, that is you know, you've talked to other people. There's a constant concern. You know, and we're renewing two of our grants from NIH right now. And, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. It's just knowing my own study section. You know, it's not an easy process even to renew. You know, continuation of grants. So. No, you always have to be looking for funding sources, you know, to keep things going. And you know, unfortunately, you know, I would say 50 to 60% of my time is spent on, you know, trying to look for you know, funding and writing grants and, you know, doing things of that sort. So, which is sort of one negative aspect, I think, of being doing you know, research in an academic setting, that sometimes you don't even have time to think about, you know, what the important research questions. You know. So. But at the same time, writing the grant helps you to think about those things, so maybe it's okay too.
Well, we haven't talked too much about why you left Cornell to come here, but we certainly can, and just to ask, how has moving from a medical college with a very basic research focus to a school of public health, which is just now the field itself, is just now, you know, taking on a more basic agenda, how has that changed your ability to garner funding for your research?
Well, I think it's too soon. You know, to know, because I've only been here a year. But, you know, I got two grants since I've been here. One is, you know, international work, but the other one is this salmonella vaccine work. So I'm not sure how, I don't think it makes any difference. I mean, I'm doing basically the same thing I was doing at Cornell in terms of my basic science lab work. And you know, this group is known for that anyways, you know. It's a new program at Berkeley, but it's a pathogenesis program. They recruited also Dan Portnoy from Penn, who has a half-time appointment at School of Public Health and half-time at MCB. They recruited a virologist from Yale, you know, who's just nothing but lab work.
It's been very successful. School of Public Health.
No, this school is known for that work anyway, so it's nothing just because it happens to be in the School of Public Health. You know, there are a couple places like that. Harvard has also a very strong lab program, you know, in the School of Public Health in this place. And
Johns Hopkins.
Yeah, Johns Hopkins, too. So I don't think that's atypical. The reason, you know, I wanted to be here was because of the epidemiology side. That you know, didn't exist at Cornell. I essentially had to do all the epidemiology myself there, you know, plus the bench workers. But here I can talk to people and, you know, I have students who are in epidemiology program who can actually learn these things by themselves. I don't have to spend as much time teaching them epidemiology. So, yeah, in terms of the ability to get funding, it might even be better here. You know, because the science is only, the basic science here at Berkeley is far superior to what it was at Cornell.
Okay.
I mean, I just go next door, MCB, and, you know, talk to, you know, people who are really doing fundamental, you know, cell biology work. Right? They're not very, you know, many sort of microbiology, you know, people here in terms of the kind of microbiology that we do. But, you know, they've recruited, you know, a couple of people. So it's really blossoming. They've also recruited Eva Harris from UCSF. She's going to join us in July.
Oh, okay.
And so it's probably going to be one of the strongest pathogenesis groups in the country in terms of, you know, just the diversity of pathogens that we work with. And
okay. So as your professional incarnation as a bacterial pathogenesis researcher, and just, you know, I'm just talking based on my experience interviewing Pew scholars and bacterial pathogenesis who are in traditionally academic basic departments, how do you think this will affect your kind of ability to do the professional things, like get invited to the right conferences and publish in the right journals and attract the right kind of students or the quality students?
No, I think this is a much better place to do that. Yeah. I mean, I get inundated with postdoc applicants already. Mm. There's just another program, and so you know, much more than that I did at Cornell. You know, it's really the program is really becoming known already, and so you know, I think in terms of my sort of bacterial pathogenesis track career, I think this is certainly a better place. It's got the critical mass of people to be able to do that, because I didn't at Cornell.
And I'm going to assume that you have no clinical responsibility.
No, yeah, nothing. Yeah, no, completely zero. That was a difficult decision.
Okay.
You know, when I watch ER on TV, I start missing.
Really?
Yeah, no, I get a little kind of a compunction. Okay. But you know, I just can't do it. There's just no time.
Yeah.
When I go to Brazil, you know, I do see patients. You know, I just see, you know, people in hospitals, kids, you know, leptospirosis and, you know, other things. And so, but not here.
Yeah. Well, one last area I want to get into.
Okay.
I said 15 minutes and we're going.
No, it's fine.
Is this issue of time and you know, maintaining both a domestic and an international career, plus having a family, and taking your family and your 8-month-old, your infants to places like India and Brazil, and I think to talk about specifically about chronology, the last time we talked about your personal life was you had gone to Columbia Presbyterian to do your internship and residency because your girlfriend was at Yale. Mm-hmm. But when do you get married to whoever you get married to?
Yeah, Jesse. Yeah, I got married to Jesse in Atlanta after we moved from New York, but. I met Jessie. She was working at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital where I was doing my residency.
Okay.
And, you know, we didn't really start going out till I guess I was in my senior year last year.
Residency.
Yes,
yeah. Okay.
But my girlfriend at the time were sort of beginning to break up, I guess. she went to Japan for a year to do her thesis. And, you know, it was a difficult long-distance relationship at that time. I actually visited or in Japan too, my vacation. But, you know, it was becoming clear that it was going to be difficult to maintain the relationship for a long time. And then in the meantime, I met Jessie. And so.
What was she working? She
was an economist. So she was getting her PhD in economy and was studying Japanese economics. And so she had to do part of her thesis project in Japan.
And,
so.
And Jessie at Columbia?
Jessie was working as a receptionist at one of the emergency rooms.
Okay.
She was going to school still at the time, so she was working part-time. And then we decided to move to Atlanta together, and then we got married. So.
And does she have a career outside the home?
She's a school teacher. Yeah. Although, you know, having just moved here, she had to renew her teacher's credentials.
Oh, yeah.
So she finished, and she'll probably go back to work when Emma starts kindergarten.
Okay. What does she teach? What grade level does she?
She was teaching junior high school when I was a fellow here in Stanford. She was teaching in San Jose.
Yeah. And does she teach in the sciences or?
No, it's everything. You know, just a junior high. She likes language arts, I guess. She's teaching English as a second language. Most of the students she had in San Jose were like Vietnamese students, Cambodian students.
And how did she view all this field work that you were doing in developing countries?
Well, you know, initially I think she was very, very supportive. you know, when we got married in Atlanta, you know, about 3 months afterwards, I went off to Bangladesh for 3 months, and you know, went to, there was no such thing as email at the time.
Right.
Had to communicate by real letters, you know. And, I also got sent to Brazil for 6 weeks, and she actually joined me in Brazil, so we traveled around. But you know, she was very supportive of that sort of thing. Now with the kids, you know, I mean, she's still supportive, of course, but you know, I think it's probably hard on her when I am away. Well, the kids are a little older, so it's not as bad as it was, I guess, when I was when I was in India. You know, in India, within India, I also traveled. So.
And what were your concerns for your the health and safety of your you know, children, particularly your infant children, knowing that you've been studying this
you know,
infantile diarrhea and uh-huh. the incredible mortality rates?
No, that was always a concern. Whenever they had, you know, diarrhea in India, we always thought of the worst possible scenario. But, we made sure that they were both breastfed as long as possible. yeah, Samantha was breastfed till she was almost three. So, but fortunately, you know, nothing happened. And, you know, we all, of course, you know, gave them all the shots, yeah. you know, before we went. And once we sort of settled in India, you know, the first month or so, we were sort of, you know, in a hotel type of setting. So it was, you know, it was difficult. We always had to, you know, eat out, and they were always getting sick. But once we sort of settled in our own place where we could control what we ate, boiling the water and doing those things, you know, it was okay. It was a lot of help, you know. And so it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. But, you know, they did get sick, and, you know, we all got sick, but unfortunately nothing bad.
And how do you explain to your older ones about what Dad does for a living and why he has to fly off to all these exotic places?
I think he's beginning to accept it. He's 11 now, so he's beginning to accept it. Although, you know, the last couple months I was been doing a lot of traveling, and so when I came home one day, he says, "Hi, Dad, how long are you visiting?"
Oh, no. And how do you react to that?
Well, you know, I mean, he was done in a very light, jovial
okay.
way. So, he's got a great sense of humor. I think he's used to, you know, my traveling. I think if anything, it's Emma, the youngest, who I think has the most difficulty.
Yeah.
She really makes sure to make you feel bad. So, it's not easy. I try, you know, I've cut down on the duration of my travels when I go to Brazil. You know, I used to go maybe 3 weeks at a time, but I rarely spend more than 10 days at a time now. So.
And at least did your oldest kids see Outbreak?
No, Nicholas hasn't seen it yet. No. You can check it out, I guess.
And do you have concerns? What are your concerns that, you know, here you are going mm-hmm. off and mm-hmm. and in this potentially dangerous situation,
mm-hmm.
And how your children will react? How do you explain?
I don't think they really perceive those things as dangerous. Yeah,
okay.
I don't think I give them the impression that these are dangerous things. So,
do you give them that it's a kind of adventurous and
it's a fun thing.
Do they express a desire to go with you?
No.
Okay.
You know, we had an opportunity actually this coming summer for all of us to spend some time in Brazil so I can work. But they're not all that excited about doing it. You know, they have their friends here.
Berkeley's a tough place to live, I guess. You had mentioned that you're here on the weekends and at night,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
when you aren't here, you're
mm-hmm,
away. And
mm-hmm.
how do you divide up family responsibilities?
I try to spend some time, to put aside time and do things in a very concentrated, you know, time period. I'm constantly conscious of, I guess, going back and forth between work and the family. So I don't think I do it enough, but It comes in spurts too, you know, if I'm writing a grant or, you know, doing some papers or things like that, I'm obviously here more often than I want to be, but you know, if I'm not doing those things, then I try to, you know, stay home. Mm. And do things, so.
And in terms of your own role as a mentor, when you have graduate students and, and fellows who are considering starting a family and still need to do field research, how do you handle this issue with them of childbearing and child-rearing?
I guess, I don't know if that's, it's come up in a couple people. Yeah, they're both MDs, because it's the MDs who do the field work. You know, the PhDs just stay in the lab, so they don't have that, those things they have to worry about. You know, and I did have PhDs who had, you know, families, and, you know, they, so, you know, I let them do whatever they need to do as long as, you know, work gets done. So it was a little easier in New York because most people lived across, you know, really close by to the hospital. So they just come in at any time they want and, you know, get the work done. Whereas here, people live farther out, so I think it's a little more difficult for them to, you know, come in on the weekends and, you know, away from their family. But the MDs, you know, I have one MD fellow in Brazil right now, and he has a child, you know, with his wife. And, it's not easy for him, I know. And we talk about it all the time. And, you know, he actually came up here to do some work in September and spent 6 weeks here. And, you know, his wife was, you know, down there with his with the little baby. And unfortunate, you know, they had an unfortunate episode. She had a miscarriage, you know, when Albert was still here. And that really affected him, I think, that he wasn't there, you know, when this happened. And so, yeah, those things, you know, we talk about them because I did the same thing, you know, and I can relate to that, you know, with people like that. So, you know, I sort of tell them, you know, my experiences in India, you know, when I had to go through that sort of stuff. And when I was trying to set up things in Mexico, you know, when I was at Stanford.
And is that just part of the package of becoming an epidemiologist? In terms of, you know, when you choose your lifestyle and professional career choices, that at all?
Yeah, you have to do it that way. It's just no... No, if that's what you want to do. I mean, if international sort of epidemiology is what you want to do, which is what, you know, Albert is really interested in. And, you know, he loves it. I mean, it's hard, but, you know... I mean, I'm trying to convince him to come back to the States. Because, you know, he has to set up his own career here. That's what he has to do. And but if I didn't say these things, he would just stay there forever. You know, he loves his wife is French, and you know, she's also not working. And, you know, she's used to traveling all over the world, too. So, you know, it's a nice couple, you know, arrangement. And their kid now speaks Portuguese and French and English growing up. And so, yeah, no, Albert is a really great... person, you know, just really cares for, you know, what he's doing there. And, very exceptional. He's probably the best fellow that I've ever had. So. And the other person that, you know, that is an MD, she's now at CDC, and she got married right before she went down to CDC. And, you know, she's struggling to, you know, deciding whether to have to raise a family or not. And, you know, she talks to me about it from time to time, even now, but, no, I don't know, you know, what the advice in situations like that. She's still trying to get her career going. And so. Talk to Eva Harris about this all the time. You know, she's also, you know, getting started. You know, wants to get family going, but just she's even more interesting. She's a woman who's doing things abroad.
And how does that make it
much
difference?
More difficult, I think, as a woman, because, you know, she has to have the baby.
Right.
And, you know, she says she's, you know, hasn't been ready, but, it's funny we talk about these things. I don't know why we talk about these things, but, you know, it's really up to her, but you know, I can see that it's much more difficult for her because she's really, you know, very dedicated to the work abroad and spent 10 years of her life in Nicaragua, you know, doing work and, so I can sympathize.
Yeah. Well, do women have to make different choices there are gender-based choices to be made in mm-hmm. terms of whether a female researcher wants to have a family mm-hmm. or not, and a male researcher wants to have a family mm-hmm. or not.
No, I think it's a lot more difficult for the women. Yeah, I just can't imagine if I were a woman having to make that decision. I know I have another friend at UCSF, Debbie Dean, who is now raising starting a family. It turns out it's going to be a twin. Actually, I should call her and see if she's already had. But anyways, she's someone who's been, working in Nepal, doing work abroad too for many, many years. Infectious disease physician and doing, basic research at UCSF. And, she finally decided to have a family. She's probably, a little younger than I am, probably early 40s, starting a family. So she's delayed it, I guess, for all these years. It's much more difficult, especially if you're doing the kind of things that I'm doing, trying to run a lab and doing work abroad. If you're just running a lab, I think it's easier.
And what are the gender-based professional difficulties that women run into? Whether it's within an academic setting or in the field, in terms of being accepted or promoting one's career.
Mm-hmm. I think it's much more difficult in an academic environment than working in the field for women.
Okay.
I see this all the time. It's not obvious, but when you see enough of examples of this happening, you begin to wonder. For the same type of work that women do, they're not as recognized as the males. It's clear.
And why is that, do you think?
I think it's the usual, mentality. Mm. It's definitely there. I think people don't accept it, or maybe they don't see it, but it comes up in interviews. Now that I'm in this sort of position, I'm sort of on the inside track, it's clear what happens. These search committees, and you think these search committees are all objective, and they look at objective information on candidates, but I think if you really look at the way it's done. Everybody, if they're honest, will agree that there's a lot of subjective, decisions made, about who gets recruited, for new positions and things. And if you happen to be on the right side of those subjective decisions, then that's fine for you. But I think women often, just because they're women, tend to I think it's a little more difficult. I certainly see this at UCSF all the time. There's one person I know, she's actually a Pew Scholar, and she's done really great work, but she just has not received the recognition that the same person same work that's done by a male in that position would have certainly gotten the recognition. So it's a clear-cut example. It's just a very glaring example of what happens. Mm. I think Berkeley too, there was one case, I don't really know, but about this particular Pew Scholar, but I don't know if you've interviewed her, but it's another example. If that work was done by a male, I think that person would have gotten tenure here.
And how can you, as an individual kind of scientist and mentor and advisor, prepare students for this reality and help them negotiate these boundaries between gender-based kind of obstacles?
Well, I think, you know, they need to recognize that those things exist. That, unfortunately, and that, you know, they need to. Well, it's hard to say. They need to really, I think, do more to be accepted into the system, to be recognized, and that's true with minorities too. I think. They need to really, really stand out to be accepted. You know, otherwise, you know.
Is that true for your case?
I don't know. I mean, I've been lucky. I've sort of passed through all the systems. I guess because they don't know how to categorize me, it makes it. But you know, it's you know, I've never felt discriminated against ever, or at least something that was, you know, obvious. I've never. I mean, you know, I didn't apply to Cornell as a medical student because one of my residents, who was from New York, who was Jewish, told me when I was a medical student at UCSF that Cornell didn't take any Jews or, you know, minorities, so don't even bother applying to Cornell. But when I went to Cornell, it was just, you know, totally different. I mean, it was just not like that at all. It was just, so certain institutions develop a certain perception that stays, and, you know, Cornell was, you know, very enlightening, you know, institution in that respect. And so there's a other extreme too, that there's certain perception that gets created. You know, you may overreact to those things when it's not there. So, but you know, from my own experience, you know, I never had, at least that I was aware of, anything taking place.
Okay, well, I could probably go ahead and ask questions all afternoon, but time is constrained, and at this point, I would like to turn it over to you and ask you if there's anything that we haven't talked about that you would like to talk about.
No, I think we've pretty much covered one of the major things. Yeah, we talked about the important people in my life, right?
Okay.
That's influenced what I'm doing. I think I mentioned, you know, the scientists. You know, talked about friends. So yeah, I can't think of anything. Warren Johnson, you know, was obviously one of the major mentors that I had. I can't think of any.
Okay, well, I think this has been a terrific interview, and thank you for the opportunity.
No, thank you. It was fun.
Okay, thanks a lot.